I'm longtime journalist and brand new podcaster Meg Heckman, and this is Radio Free Dystopia, a podcast about what we learn when dystopian fiction and real-life current events start to look the same. I'm here with my co-host, Toby Ball. Toby, how are you today?
I am doing pretty well, Meg. How about you?
You're okay. That's good. And Toby is a writer of dystopian novels and a panelist on the hit podcast Crime Writers On. And our guest today is Clay Wirestone. Clay is the news editor of the Topeka Capital Journal in Topeka, Kansas, and a writer whose work has appeared in many places, including Mental Floss. Clay, how are you?
I am delighted to be here, Meg.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and you are actually our first ever remote guest, because audience, we are actually recording remotely for the first time ever. We've gotten some feedback about the sound quality of our early episodes, and we're hoping that this one, by recording this way, will be better. So please bear with us while we work out some kinks. We have Clay here for a reason today. It's because he's A, awesome, and B, a journalist. And we're going to talk about journalism today, because if we were writing a handbook on, say, how to build a dystopian state, chapter one would be all about suppressing a free press. So my first question for you guys is, why is that? What is the importance of a free press in a non-dystopian society?
I like how you narrow it down to something really specific.
Right.
There,
yeah.
Meg. That's really helpful. You know, I mean, I think this goes to what journalists like to believe they are, which is, you know, kind of guardians of truth and accuracy and fairness, and kind of presenting the most truthful kind of view possible in the quickest amount of time, in the least amount of time, basically, of current events. And, you know, kind of under the standard model that we've all come to believe, more or less, you know, you got to have that kind of daily, reliable, kind of steady, non-sensationalized coverage to truly know what's going on in the world around you.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you're right. I mean, the reason that I started that conversation so broadly is because these are broad and almost ephemeral needs for civic life. I mean, there are specific things that journalists do, but journalism is this broad and kind of always changing practice. So that was a good rundown. Toby, how about you? Why do you think this idea of having a free press is so important for a non-dystopian society?
Well, I think specifically as it relates to kind of dystopian and non-dystopian societies is that, you know, whether you support them or not, you know, the government likes to put out its narrative about what's going on, right? And so journalism in a free society is there. It's not necessarily to counter the narrative, but it's to evaluate it and to provide sort of a non-biased counter to it. And by, I don't mean counter by being like a debate, but by being, you know, rather than just taking the state at its word, is you provide some facts and some analysis in order to inform people about what, you know, as close to the truth as possible lies there. And I think in what we kind of look at as models of dystopian states, like the Soviet Union, for instance, you know, the newspapers there were organs of the state, right? So that's kind of the way it looks like in sort of this classic dystopia, is that the journalists who are supposed to be sort of a break on the state and fact-checking and providing some truth against the narrative in dystopian states are just furthering the narrative. It's just another way for the state to get out their story.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think one of the most classic fictional examples of that is in 1984, right?
Right. Well, in 1984, they've got it both coming and going in that the state runs the newspaper, but then it also is willing to go back and, you know, if some attitude towards a person has changed or the state made a statement that then turned out not to be true, they go the, you know, the extra yard is going back and changing newspapers so that if somebody goes back and looks in the records, what they'll find is that the state had been right, even though, you know, originally that was not the case.
Right. Absolutely. Clay, do you have any favorite fictional examples of either a press that is really heroic or has kind of been muzzled?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, and just kind of these classic examples of dystopia that you're talking about. I mean, you obviously remember 1984 and stuff along that line. I mean, I just can't get over how important the actual folks who created these dystopias thought the press was.
Right.
To me, you know, that's what's fascinating is, you know, this notion somehow that the state needs to run the newspaper, that the newspaper is so important, or that the media is so important, that of course the state would be interested in running it. You know, and I think a lot of journalists these days would be very flattered to feel like they felt the government thought they were important enough to want to run them.
Right. If now the government doesn't want to run the press, it certainly wants to control it in a lot of ways. And so I am going to take us through a real life rundown of some recent threats to press freedoms here in the United States.
Time for another fact-filled edition of The News from Dystopia.
Journalism has never been easy. And in many parts of the world, it's a dangerous business. But here in the U.S., reporters benefit from what we like to think is the freest press in the world. Lately, though, the people in power, or a lot of the people in power, including President Trump, don't seem to entirely understand what that means. It's felt lately like every week, every month has come with a new and troubling threat to the privileges and rights that journalists rely on to do their jobs. President Trump has repeatedly called reporters enemies of the people. President Trump has also, at various points in his recent political career, threatened to loosen libel laws and to sue reporters that he doesn't like or news organizations that he doesn't like. Last month, it was revealed that Trump suggested to former FBI Director James Comey that the FBI should jail journalists who publish classified information. Let's just pause for a second. The President of the United States is accused of telling the Director of the FBI that maybe we should jail journalists for publishing information that is necessary for a free and open society. And last week, to look at this at a more local level, a Republican congressional candidate named Greg Gianforte was charged with simple assault after allegedly body slamming a reporter who asked him about the new health care bill. The candidate won election despite an audio recording of the incident.
This has been The News from Dystopia. Until next time, stay hopeful.
If I can kind of follow up on that, I mean, you didn't even touch on the reporter who was arrested in West Virginia for
right.
trying to ask Tom Price, who is a member of Donald Trump's cabinet, a question, which to me in some ways
is the most chilling of all of those,
because there you're taking a journalist who's just in the course of doing his basic business. And it's not like one guy losing his cool, or it's not sort of words as chilling as that is, but they actually had this guy arrested for doing nothing other than just doing the job of journalism, which to me seemed like that was a fairly significant step, even though it didn't get a whole lot of press coverage.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, you know, in a normal political climate, that would be the big press freedom story. But there have just been so many instances like this where it feels like not just the legal underpinnings of a free press, but also the cultural norms that enable responsible journalists to do their jobs, those are really at risk. And this isn't just happening at the federal level. You know, Clay and I both worked for a long time at the same awesome local newspaper here in New Hampshire, and Clay now works at another really awesome local news organization in Kansas. Clay, can you talk a little bit about kind of the state of press freedoms at the local level right now?
It's one of those issues that can be very different based literally on what state you're in, because kind of state open records laws vary really widely. New Hampshire, where I was, you know, did not have great open records laws, as you may remember, as you may recall.
Oh yes.
Whereas Kansas has better ones. Florida, where I worked for a few years, has excellent open records laws. And one of the things that the Capital Journal is very aggressive about, and all of our reporters are aggressive about, is that if there is a closed meeting, if there are secret records of any kind, we just want them, you know, and we make it a practice to request under the Open Records Act basically everything we can find. And, you know, what's interesting is, you know, we don't just do it if we feel like, oh, there's something that may be untoward there. I mean, most of the time, frankly, there isn't. But kind of out of the principle of the thing, we try, you know, if there's ever a record, you know, we want it. We actually, you know, some of our folks, there was a small town, there was a, called Holton, Kansas. It's nearby. There was a, it was a rape case. The guy was actually acquitted, although he faces many other charges, but a judge had sealed some testimony in kind of a closed hearing that he'd had. He'd not given advance warning that he was going to have the hearing, which actually runs afoul of the open records law. And so we requested this, you know, our there was a little road trip, our attorney went up there, and we got the information from that released. And, you know, it was actually, I don't want to say it was totally innocuous. It you know, it was not particularly damning. But, you know, the point is that we push really hard to put things on the public record at all times. And I, you know, that's probably, you know, the least dystopian thing, hopefully, that you can do.
That's such a great example of what everyday quality watchdog journalism looks like all across America. You know, it's not spotlight. It's not, you know, Deep Throat meeting you in a parking garage in this kind of glamorous sort of way. It's just diligent, basic watchdog journalism. And by calling it basic, I don't mean in any way to minimize it. And it takes resources and it takes time. And I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize who maybe have not worked in local media. Because I think a lot of times when we think of that more public persona of a journalist, we think of a journalist as either a hero or a journalist as maybe not a villain, but more of an anti-hero. And Toby, in your novels, you use journalists as characters quite a bit. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Sure. Well, you know, what I'm writing are basically sort of mystery thrillers. And, you know, the one thing, and they're dystopian. So the one thing that's attractive, I think, about journalists in that role is that, you know, the hero is this guy, Frank Frings. Like, he's investigating his society. You know, he's investigating the city that he lives in. So while all of them sort of, all the books kind of have a crime at the center of them, you know, I didn't, my interest in writing them was more about how the society works around them. And that's not really something that a detective is necessarily all that concerned with. But I think a journalist was a character who could look beyond like the small facts of this one incident and dig into how it either reflects or affects sort of society at large. And that was really what I was more interested in the writing. So that was kind of where I was going at. with a journalist. And then you also, you know, you can include a lot of sort of detective-like stuff, you know, following up on clues, having sources, all that kind of stuff can happen too, but the scope is a little bit broader. I guess I was also looking at journalists, certain journalists from the past who, and it's not to say that people now don't have it, but had sort of a definite sort of take on the world or sort of a theory about the way things worked. And that was part of this guy Frank Fring's character, is that he interprets things through a certain lens. Like, he has a theory about the way things work. And I think when you're writing dystopian novels, that's sort of one of the essential characteristics, I think, of a good hero, is even if he doesn't at the beginning have some sort of framework through which he views what's going on around him or her, that person develops it as it goes along.
So I like that idea of kind of that evolution of understanding of the world, in your case, a fictional world. But for working journalists, we're talking about, you know, the real world around us. Clay, can you think of any examples just from your own professional life about how journalism's understanding of the world has evolved?
I think, you know, a lot of what we've thought of as journalism for so long has been based on the newspaper model. Like, even if it was radio or TV, you had sound, you had moving pictures, but it was still basically a newspaper in the sense that some entity collected the stories at a regular basis and would, like, deposit it in front of you. You know, and so journalism was the kind of the regular accretion of these stories. And it sounds kind of gross, but that was what it was. And I think now, you know, the notion of what journalism is, the notion of what media is just so much broader. And this is why, like, you know, early in the show, I was talking about, you know, I think in some ways journalists would like more attention sometimes, because I think ultimately the real threat to a free press is not necessarily government interference, but just general cultural irrelevance.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, because we're all part of this kind of gigantic rushing river now of everyone creating media, you know, through all of the social news channels, through everything. And, you know, and at this point, it's not that there's not a role for kind of the traditional establishment media, but, you know, you have to be in that river. You know,
right.
You can't try to dam it up, because you're going to be, you know, swept away. But, you know, so it means that you're just part of all of these other things, you know, and I see now at my job, you know, it's expected that reporters are in, you know, certain community Facebook groups.
Right.
It's expected that you're following and watching these certain things, because frankly, there's a community Facebook group that will probably know certain things, you know, better than you do.
Right. And so with that rise of social media, and we've talked about this before on the show, how does that change the way that journalists deal with credibility and veracity in their work?
Personally, I think it shouldn't change it,
mm-hmm.
but I think it forces journalists to realize their limitations.
Right.
In the sense that there's only so much, in some cases, that presenting all the facts will get you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think journalists like to believe, you know, in the Watergate model, where if you follow the facts, you know, then, you know, you've got a corrupt president or whatever, and the president resigns and, you know, and everything is fine. But, you know, I think we've had ample evidence in decades since then that just because you uncover facts and just because you put them in front of the people, you know, you have done your job as a journalist. But
mm-hmm.
that does not necessarily mean that people are going to act in a particular way once they have those facts in front of them.
Right.
And, you know, and that is, I think, why a lot of people, you know, in the media, in the news media, certainly there was a certain amount of soul searching after the election, because I think for a lot of people, they felt like the reporting they did, the work they did, should have led to a certain outcome, and it did not. And so I think there's a real question about like what is the job of journalism, you know, and this notion so long that we've had that, you know, the a certain unbiased, objective, fair, you know, effort report, you know, how far does that get you? And I think, you know, it's intrinsically limited probably.
So I've got a question, I guess, for both of you, which is, you know, you talk about like laying the facts out. To what extent do you think that journalists have the responsibility of helping the listeners interpret those facts? Because that seems to me to be where a lot of the sort of information wars go on, is that stuff is kind of laid out and then you've got these competing sides trying to spin it this way and that. And I think that's what becomes hard for people to evaluate, or people just kind of lean on their sort of reflexive ideological interpretation of things rather than sort of a more reasoned analysis.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And I think it's a hard challenge for journalists, because I do think, and Clay, jump in here at any time, I do think that interpretation and finding meaning in just the onslaught of information that the average person gets just living his or her daily life, I think that's a really important role for journalists. And, you know, there are some cases where it's pretty basic. So again, to go back to local journalism, Clay was still here in New Hampshire when the story happened. The local paper that we both worked at, it's called the Concord Monitor. The staff there did this really amazing series about this persistent problem of homelessness here in our area. And the reporters and photographers and editors involved made it their job to humanize members of the homeless community in a way that really, I think, helped readers and policymakers understand the factors at work behind chronic homelessness. And so I think in those cases, there's a clear role for local news organizations to bring meaning and context. I think it gets much harder when we start wading into partisan politics, because I mean, we've all, even those of us who like I like to think of myself as pretty open-minded, but it's hard if you are faced with facts that run counter to something that you believe or want to believe is true. So it can be really hard for even good, calm, responsible, independent journalists to communicate and interpret facts to people who might not want to believe them. What do you think, Clay?
Well, I think there's a distinction to draw here. And one of the things that we're very proud of here in Topeka is we do a lot of coverage of the state capital and the maneuvering there. And, you know, Kansas has kind of a famous / notorious, you know, kind of state government. We had big tax cuts a few years ago, and now we're facing some big budget holes as a result of that. But, you know, we cover, you know, basically everything that goes on in the legislature. You know, there's basically no story that we don't write. We want to make it very clear what's going on. We want to make it very clear what the proposals will do and what they don't do. And, you know, if that involves kind of fact checking during a story, you know, if someone says a plan will do a certain thing, but that's not backed up, you know, we do say that. And I think in a broader sense, you know, we saw this in the 2016 election. It was an election that was fact-checked, and it was fact-checked very frequently. You know, you had in Donald Trump a candidate who, you know, his entire, you know, he stretched the truth a lot and went even beyond that. And there were no shortage of outlets to say, you know, what the actual facts were in any situation. And you know, and I think in almost all sorts of races, there, you know, since then, and even a few years before that, you know, there's much more of a willingness of the press to step up and say, listen, these are the facts. I think where the distinction comes is when you then say, well, if we agree on the facts, if the facts are compelling, then what should we do? Mm-hmm. Or what should you do? And, you know, this is something traditionally that newspapers leave to the editorial pages or leave to the, you know, the editorial board to decide and making an endorsement or something along those lines.
Right.
And I think kind of as Meg and I have learned it and as we've practiced it in journalism, you know, we can't take that last step. You know, that's not really our role as a journalist to, you know, to say, well, you've got the facts, we've figured out the truth, but then what do you do? Who do you vote for? You know, how should you feel about this? And, you know, it's, you know, kind of as the way that our entire kind of worldview is constructed as journalists is we don't do that.
Right.
You know, now, could it be that you move into a world or you move into a situation where a different kind of journalist, you know, journalism, you know, a much more advocacy focused kind of thing, you know, comes into vogue, you know, that may well be the case, but, you know, that's not what most journalists do now still.
Right. And it's worked, you know, for so many years, it's worked at the local level, at the national level, and everything in between. I mean, and journalism is not perfect. We call it a practice for a reason. And I feel like I say that every episode, but it's true. But it just feels like we're in this different landscape now where we can't agree on a shared set of facts. And that, to me, just feels distinctly dystopian. And I don't know what the way forward is. What do you guys think?
Well, I mean, I think that was, you know, one of the thoughts behind that. My question was, and this is, you know, it's always funny in this podcast is like, not that we live in a dystopia, but in a dystopian setting, is laying out the facts and letting that speak for itself, is that adequate, or, you know, does there need to be, you know, something more behind it? And I think, you know, my sense is, and sometimes my frustration with the press is that there's a way of making a point about facts that doesn't have to be ideologically driven, but can be more. And this is not to say that there aren't journalists who do this, and I guess I'm thinking more of like this sort of CNN, and MSNBC, and then like the network television, where, you know, they'll kind of put out, especially sort of a very complicated economic issue, and then there'll be two sort of ways of addressing it or whatever, but then they don't do much in the way of evaluating it. So there, it's hard to know. And I follow this stuff fairly closely. And if I didn't follow it more closely, like, I don't even know how I'd begin to sort of interpret what different political parties were saying about how to address it. And that seems to me, where sometimes journalists or journalistic organizations seem reluctant to, and I think part of it is that, you know, the right in our country has really set up this situation where you know, conservatives sort of reflexively don't trust the media, or at least the national media, and that the national media responds by bending over backwards to try and legitimize sometimes totally bullshit beliefs.
Right. And that idea of false balance. And we see that come up. I mean, that came up for years in conversations about climate change. And, you know, the way that we cover that has changed a little bit. But yeah, absolutely.
Which, you know, I would point out, too, that, I mean, I think it is, you know, it's very easy because we live in such a polarized time to see everything, you know, through the ideological lens. But, you know, one of the things about dystopias, of course, is that they're not necessarily always right or left wing. You know, they can be either or both, or neither. But the point is that, you know, within the, you know, few months so far that we've had, you know, a Trump administration, there have been, you know, noted more or less cranks on the left at this point now, who kind of feed what used to be, you know, a left-wing version of alternative facts. You know, there's I saw an article that was just written, just posted to BuzzFeed a day or two ago about impeachment, and was Chris Geidner, the author, was trying to point out that a lot of people on the left are believing crazy things about how impeachment works, and that like one person can do it, and that Trump is just like days away from being impeached. And so the point is that when you are not, when the side that you're aligned with does not have its hands on the levers of power, it is very easy to be manipulated into believing things by people who are seem to be sympathetic to your values.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I saw that exact same bogus article floating around social media, and I was shocked by the people who were sharing it. I mean, these are people who I would consider to be informed citizens, and I think they got fooled. I don't think they were knowingly sharing bad information, but it gets back to what I was saying earlier, where if you want to believe something badly enough, if you are so upset about the way things are going or the way things might be, you might accidentally contribute to this incremental loss of a shared fact base. And one
more point about this, which is that, you know, we talk about, you know, things that Trump may have said, you know, alleged to have said about, you know, jailing journalists. But it's also true that for all that folks on the left at this point are, you know, concerned about that, and rightfully so, you know, the Obama administration had an unparalleled war on whistleblowers and actually did threaten to jail many journalists over, you know, classified leaks, you know, about things like the drone program and other, you know, highly classified intelligence situations. And I mean, I guess the point is that, again, you know, and this is where I feel like it kind of loops back to dystopian stuff. This is about power structures a lot of times. And you have a national security power structure. You have a federal government power structure. And ultimately, you know, whichever party is in there is going to be extremely unhappy about information, you know, unauthorized information coming out.
Right, absolutely. And I also think this gets back to Toby's point earlier about what makes journalists such compelling characters, narrators in fiction, because of what we do, we are able to kind of walk up and down the ladder of power in any given society. And from a narrative standpoint, like, that's great. You can build a really interesting story around that, whether it's fiction or nonfiction. So that's definitely interesting. One of the other things that I have found fascinating, just kind of in my own tour of various dystopian franchises, is the different ways that reporters are portrayed. You know, there are a few examples where they don't exist at all. An example of this would be The Handmaid's Tale, which we talked about last time, and we will talk about again in the very near future. There's this line in the book where the protagonist is remembering reading newspapers in bed with her husband, and there's a little side note saying, well, there were newspapers then. Basically, you know, there aren't now. And not only that, nobody's allowed, women at least, aren't allowed to read in this dystopian society. There are no words anywhere. So information is really locked down in a lot of different ways. And then there are, you know, the 1984 example that we talked about before, where the state is just controlling news organizations. And then there are kind of these other weird, more gray area portrayals of journalists. And I just wanted to share one with you guys from Brave New World. And if you have not read, listeners, if you have not read Brave New World since middle school or high school, pick it up and read it again. It's really, really good. It had probably been 20 years since I read it, and I got so much out of it. And there's this scene really near the end. I don't want to give anything away, but there's this scene near the end where a journalist for a news organization called the Hourly Radio shows up to report on something that's going on. And he is described as touching his hat, quote, the aluminum stovepipe hat in which he carried his wireless receiver and transmitter. So even in a book written, you know, almost a century ago, there's this idea of, basically this is a, you know, dystopian version of a mobile journalist. And this idea of the press kind of being everywhere, and this scene evolves into a press gaggle, just completely fascinated with this one really salacious story about this one character in the book. And it kind of, to me, spoke to the way that threats to responsible journalism don't always come from outside. Sometimes they can come from the ways that we as practitioners choose to use the reporting tools at our disposal. So I have two questions for you, Clay. One, do you want a hat like that? Actually,
I just want to make all of our reporters have hats like that.
Okay. What would that allow them to do, do you think?
You know, just it's a mobile reporting studio. It's great. Let's do it.
It's kind of like an iPhone. But you know, how do you, as somebody who is making editorial decisions on a daily basis, how do you balance the need for, you know, we call it broccoli journalism, and, you know, maybe chocolate cake journalism?
Well, I mean, I think that's a fabulous question. And I mean, it's kind of the rub now that, you know, as I was saying, you know, we're part of this gigantic river of social media now that, you know, there's a lot of cute cats in that river, you know, there's mm-hmm. a lot of gifts of various things. So, I think honestly, and you can see this across the landscape now, you have to be able to walk and chew gum. You know, right. You have to be able to do responsible accountability journalism. But, you know, you also have to be able to and willing to do like a light and silly feature, because it allows you to do a lot of other things. And this isn't actually like a new trade-off either. I mean, it's what newspapers and publications have done for a long time. You know, you want to mix. You don't just want to give people the hardest of news. But yeah, I mean, you it involves asking a lot of your reporters. You ask them to be able to switch, and you ask them to do more. Yeah,
absolutely. Toby, how about you? Just in your, you know, you're a pretty diligent consumer of information about current events. What kind of mix do you want to see in your daily news diet?
You know, I don't, I understand the need for the, you know, the sort of light, more lighthearted or touching pieces that go in there. I'm not necessarily the audience for that. And I think one of the things that's, you know, Clay talks about, you know, this vast amount of information that's now available, and, you know, the positive thing for me is, you know, there's just so much out there that you're not limited to your local newspaper anymore, or your local newspaper plus you get like the New York Times on Sunday or something.
Right.
So that it is pretty easy to, like, even on just like an event or something that you're particularly interested in, you can read 2, 3, 4, 5 different, publications reporting on that event, and get a more nuanced picture of it by reading all of them. So I think that's kind of a positive thing as far as I'm concerned. And then, you know, the sports.
Absolutely. So listeners, I think if you are interested in this interplay between a free press and dystopian societies, our book recommendation for this week really gets deep into those questions. It's a book called It Can't Happen Here, and it's by Sinclair Lewis. It's an old book. It's a classic, and it is it's a little heavy to get through. I would suggest, if you are reading it, to keep Wikipedia handy so you can Google the names of key political figures in the first part of the 20th century in the United States, because it's one of the reasons why the book was so profound at the time is because it felt really real. And it had the names and in some cases the personas of real people in America during the first few decades of the 20th century. And the whole story is about the rise of fascism and how fascism comes to the United States. And one of the most chilling passages is about the crackdown on press freedoms. And Lewis actually lists the names of about a dozen real working journalists in the United States at that time. And so for me, you know, it's not the books, it's not a page turner, but it's really worth reading and talking about in the context of what we're talking about on this show today. Have either of you read that book?
I purchased it.
That's okay.
I have heard about it. For many years, I've heard about it.
Excellent, excellent. Yeah, and the protagonist is a newspaper editor, Clay. So maybe that'll get you to pick it up.
I do think an important point that we should make when talking about dystopias is, you know, at this point, you know, in the show, we've been talking largely about, you know, basically fascist style, you know, authoritarian kind of regimes, the kind of thing that, you know, we saw happen in Europe in the early 20th century. But one of the things that I think it's important to bear in mind about our current society is just the way that, you know, capitalism itself and market forces, you know, don't just shape government, but, you know, actually shape the news itself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this goes to what, you know, Toby was talking about, you know, and kind of this whole notion of clickbait, which is that there's, you know, these other factors that are going along, you know, kind of heading, you know, that are part of this, that shape everything that we see and hear as well. And while it's maybe hard to say that they're exactly dystopian in the same way, you know, certainly the influence of, you know, the influence of where, you know, kind of where the money is in society at any one point has a big influence on its journalism.
Have you seen any of The Keepers?
No. Tell us about that, Toby.
The Keepers, I don't want to go too far down the dystopian road on this, but it's about a murdered nun in Baltimore in the late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And she, I'm only about halfway through it, but it was within the context of abuse within a Catholic girls' school. And the sort of, I'm about halfway through, but one of the things they're trying to make very clear is that Baltimore is this very Catholic city, and that affects all the institutions of government and social order in Baltimore, so that, you know, the Catholic Church is involved with the police, and they're involved with the mayor's office, and there's a sense, and they talk to journalists, that the Catholic Church is one of the pillars of Baltimore power, and that absolutely affects the way everything in this story is told.
Right, and you know, that's a really, really good point, because the press, news organizations, particularly in metropolitan areas like that, they are also part of the power structure. And it can be really easy for even well-intentioned news organizations to suffer from institutional bias, whether they realize it or not. And so in many ways, that's an example where this river of social media and information that Clay's been talking about has the potential to actually help make the narrative more representative and more accurate and hold accountable the organizations that are responsible for truth-telling.
And I mean, and I just think it's ultimately important for journalists to be able to say, you know, to see where the power structures are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is it government? Is it economic? Is it, you know, the businesses in town? Are, you know, individuals, whatever? And you know, and the thing is no journalist goes into the field to say, you know, I'm going to, you know, end this or root out this or whatever. I mean, hopefully root out, you know, wrongdoing, I guess. But it is important, I think, for journalists to always be aware of what those levers of power are,
right,
that are around them, you know, and sometimes to work with them and sometimes to press against them, but to always know that they're there.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, we've talked a lot today about power structures and power dynamics, which I think is important for two reasons. One, it's at the heart of so many of the dystopian stories that we're talking about. And two, my brother, who's been listening to this podcast, has told me he has started a drinking game where anytime one of us says the word power, power dynamics, or power structures, he drinks. So, Jimmy, I hope you have some good cocktails yes. while you're listening to this. We are just about out of time. So listeners, I just want to remind you all that you can find us on Twitter at RF Dystopia. You can leave a comment on our website at radiofreedystopia.com, or you can send us an email, or even better, a voice memo at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com. Let us know what you think about the role that responsible journalism should play in a free, open, and non-dystopian society. Where do you go to get your news? What do you wish journalists would do more of or do differently? Tell us, and maybe we'll share some of your comments on an upcoming episode. Speaking of upcoming episodes, in our next show, we will circle back to The Handmaid's Tale. We've gotten a couple of listener voice memos with their impressions of both the book and the Hulu series, so please keep that coming. We'd love to hear from you. Toby, where can people find you online?
They can find me on Twitter at TobyBallNH, and sort of Friday evenings or Saturday morning on Crime Writers On podcast.
Awesome. And Clay, thank you so much for being our first ever remote guest and laying down some serious local journalism knowledge. Where can people find you online?
Of course. You can find me on Twitter at Clay Wires. My personal website, claywires.com, and check out the journalism that I'm part of at cjonline.com.
That's great. And folks, I've never set foot in Kansas, and I really enjoy going to that website. It is some damn good local journalism. You should check it out. And I'm online at Meg_Heckman. Again, huge thanks to Clay Wirestone for joining us today. Radio Free Dystopia is a production of Partners in Crime Media. If you like what you hear, please, please, please share with your friends and give us a review on Stitcher, on Google Play, or on Apple Podcasts. It really, really helps us. Until next time, this is Radio Free Dystopia. Partners in Crime Media.